This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
the ancient Greek and Roman world has been used by white supremacists to defend white supremacy currently and in the past. I should say, you know, in case it's not overwhelmingly clear, that this idea is absolutely appalling to the mainstream of the field, that our field could be used this way. And many of us feel like, you know, what do we do about it? Right now, it feels like it's a sort of fringe group trying to appropriate what we're doing without really understanding. You know, they don't have the background to even make correct claims about the Greek and Roman past. But I think a lot of us feel like it's incumbent upon us to do our best to be speaking very vocally against that kind of appropriation.
A conversation on how white nationalist groups, supremacists from the past, have used the classical world to reinforce their worldviews. Our guest is Sarah Teets. She is a classicist at the University of Virginia, and she is the author of a new article that's called Classical Slavery and Jeffersonian Racism, Charlottesville, 1 year later. She joins us next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Italian officials say the death toll in the collapse of a highway bridge in the city of Genoa has risen. They're now confirming that the number of dead was now at least 35 people and that 11 others who were injured have been pulled from the rubble. A huge section of the Morandi Bridge on a main highway linking Italy with France collapsed today in Genoa during a sudden violent storm, sending vehicles plunging nearly 150 feet into a heap of rubble below. Hundreds of rescue workers with sniffer dogs are searching through the tons of rubble and twisted metal, looking for more victims. Officials say it's too early to say what caused the deadly collapse, but a structural engineer specializing in bridges said corrosion or weather conditions could have been the cause. The British government has kept its threat level for terrorism at severe after a car slammed into a barrier outside the Houses of Parliament. The decision not to elevate the threat level followed a meeting of the government's emergency committee today. Metropolitan Police Assistant Commissioner Neil Basu has said no other suspects have been identified, and police believe there is no further threat to Londoners.
Given that this appears to be a deliberate act, the method, and this being an iconic site, we are treating it as a terrorist incident, and the investigation is being led by officers from the Counter-Terrorism Command. At this early stage of the investigation, no other suspects at the scene have been identified or reported to police.
Prime Minister Theresa May urged the country to come together and carry on as normal, even as she urged the public to remain vigilant. British authorities say they have foiled 13 Islamic extremist plots and 4 far-right plots since March 2017. Afghan officials said the Taliban overran a base in northern Afghanistan, killing 17 soldiers, even as Afghan forces battled the insurgents for the 5th straight day in the eastern provincial capital of Ghazni today. There were fears for the fate of the other troops from the base known as Camp Chania, as the Taliban claimed that dozens had surrendered to them while others were captured in battle. The attack in the north took place in Faryab province in the district of Gormak. Along with the 17 troops killed, at least 19 soldiers were reportedly wounded. Most of Yosemite National Park is set to reopen after a 20-day closure that cost the surrounding communities millions of tourism dollars. Yosemite Valley, which includes most of the park's major attractions, is set to reopen today. The nearly 3-week closure was the result of the massive nearby Ferguson wildfire that has burned 150 square miles and killed 2 firefighters since it started last month. Meanwhile, authorities say a Utah firefighter has died battling the largest recorded blaze in California history. Authorities say the man died last night at a hospital after he was injured at the site of the Mendocino Complex fire north of San Francisco. The Mendocino Complex, actually twin fires being fought together, has burned for more than 2 weeks. The fire has burned an area larger than the city of Los Angeles. California's newest state senator has the dubious distinction of serving one of the shortest terms in the legislature's history as she fills out the remainder of the term of disgraced former state senator Tony Mendoza, who resigned amid sexual harassment allegations. KPFK's Ernesto Arce reports.
Montebello Mayor Vanessa Delgado has been sworn in as the Southland's newest representative in the state Senate, but she had to give up her city job to do it. And since she was only elected to fill out the remaining portion of Senator Tony Mendoza's term, she'll only be in office in Sacramento for about 80 days. Mendoza resigned in the face of sexual harassment allegations earlier this year. Delgado, who is now the former mayor of Montebello, will step aside in November when voters will choose between Republican business owner Rita Topalian and Democrat Bob Archuleta to serve a new term that will begin in early December.
And that report from KPFK's Ernesto Arce. And I'm Max Pringle. Letters and Politics is next.
Welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Over the past year, we have done a number of shows on the Western classical world, meaning ancient Greek and Roman societies. Now, I can see reasons for doing these. That's why we've done them. These ancient civilizations had a democracy, had a republic, respectively. The written and archaeological record from these civilizations is pretty good, though with big gaps, obviously. And I believe that these civilizations were grappling with some of the issues that we face today as well, like political strife, representation, political enfranchisement, multicultural societies, long wars, which may at the time seem like forever wars, demagoguery, and also inequality. But there is another reason I started, even just personally, paying close attention to these classical worlds, and that was the realization that many of today's white nationalist groups also pay a lot of attention to the classical world, in fact, draw great inspiration from it. So I wanted to know more of what that was all about. You know, history is funny. You basically can use it to defend any position you want. It usually does happen that way. And that's why I have always thought that history is as much about the time that it's being studied as the time that it comes from. Now, in my own personal studies, I saw the classical world, which won't be surprising, somewhat different than the way that the white nationalists did. And I thought it was important not to allow them to have dominion, complete dominion over this area. But that said, I can also see what they got out of it. In fact, white supremacists have been using the classical world to support their worldview going back to the founders, and even before the founders, but especially the founders. And that's what we are going to be talking about today, because I was lucky enough to find an article that begins to dive into this very issue. Joining me via Skype is Sarah Teets. Sarah Teets is a postdoctoral fellow in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Virginia. Her interests are in how identities are formed and performed in Greek prose, especially Josephus. She is the author of a new article on the website called Eidolon.pub. Now, Eidolon.pub is this interesting website that's dedicated to stories that incorporates progressive politics and feminism into classical studies, sort of the antithesis of what the white nationalists are doing. And she is the author of an article that's called Classical Slavery and Jeffersonian Racism, Charlottesville, 1 year later. Sarah Teets, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you, Mitch. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I know you just had to listen to my whole diatribe there at the top. I don't know if you want to expand or contest or have your own perspective about what's happening with the classical world in today's political discourse.
Yeah, well, I would say, first of all, that I'm 100% in agreement that I'm not okay with the appropriation of my discipline of classics and the discipline of classics that so many people enjoy and find meaning in being appropriated by white nationalists and white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And also to acknowledge that this phenomenon of the appropriation of Greek and Roman antiquity is absolutely nothing new. As I wrote for Eidolon, it's something that Thomas Jefferson was actively doing. It's something that we see throughout the history of white supremacy in the United States. I recently heard a really great paper at a conference in my field last spring about, for example, the use of the classics in the formation of the Ku Klux Klan. It was being widely done in Nazi Germany. Anywhere that you're going to find white supremacists, you're probably going to see some type of appropriation of Greek and Roman antiquity cropping up.
What do you think that is? Is it just this appeal to Western civilization? I mean, and I guess, you know, we can always put a question mark of what Western civilization really even is, but do you think that's what it is?
Well, yeah. So I think if we take Western civilization to be essentially a construct that is created over time and in step with European imperialism and colonization, then we can look at how European imperial powers were using Greek and Roman antiquity in many ways to justify what they were doing. And I don't think we can ever really separate white supremacy from the rise of European imperialism and the transatlantic slave trade. And all of this is happening as race ideologies are being developed in many ways to justify this type of imperial colonial violence. And if you can map it, you can map this project onto, say, the Roman Empire, or talk about the ancient Greeks and Romans as somehow presenting a foundation for what you're doing, then I think you can, I suppose, in your own mind, ennoble something that doesn't deserve to be ennobled. It presents a sort of justification for the project. So if you look at the fact that for a very, very long time throughout Europe and places that were colonized by Europe, including where I am here in Charlottesville, Virginia, the Greek and Roman body of literature, Greek and Latin literature, are so central to the education system for a very long time. And in many ways, it's the study of Greek and Latin languages and the ancient texts written in those languages that becomes the foundation for elite body of men, primarily men. It serves to mark an identity as a part of the, whether it's an aristocratic class or a ruling class, you're the educated elite if you've studied Greek and Latin at a very high level, as Thomas Jefferson did, for instance, as I talked about in the article, then it becomes a sort of status symbol to have this type of education and to be able to be conversant in Greek and Roman antiquity. And I think that what we're looking at now is white supremacists, neo-Nazis, white nationalists are trying to tap into this, but it can become pretty obvious pretty quickly that they don't really generally know what they're talking about when they're trying to talk about Greek and Roman antiquity.
Well, I guess including race. Our mm-hmm. notion of race is a pretty modern one.
Yes.
I mean, if you compare, I say modern, compared if you compare it to the classical world.
Yes, that's true. Our notions of white and black and our very specific kinds of race formations, race ideologies are, again, the product of imperialism, colonialism, slavery, and the very specific ways that that we have constructed our world in our current context. And so the idea of a white person is maybe 400 or 500 years old. It's not much older than that. And for someone who studies the ancient world, that's really, really modern.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. And so it's completely wrong for any white supremacist, and I would include Thomas Jefferson under that label, to believe that they can trace the history of white people back to antiquity, because there are, you know, so many other scholars out there, academics and across many, many fields, who have argued very conclusively that the concept of race is a social construct. It's not, as many people used to believe, and some still do, unfortunately, it's not a biological reality. It is a social construct. It's an idea that functions and that power can operate through, but it's not grounded in a biological reality, and therefore it's not intrinsic to the human experience in the specific kinds of categories that we have. That said, in the Greek and Roman world and in antiquity, they did have concepts of race, but they were very different from ours. They did not think of themselves as being white, because that idea just had not been invented yet. And so it's just not true that Greeks and Romans were white, or that they somehow represent a past, a racial past that is somehow, you know, has continuously existed through through the present day. And you'll find white supremacists and neo-Nazis making these kinds of claims, as Nazis during the Third Reich in Germany did as well. But of course, their term of choice is Aryan, and they believed in this, you know, kind of mythical thing called the Aryan race. It's not a real thing that they believed somehow traveled around and cropped up here and there throughout basically Europe throughout history, and that they themselves were the kind of current version of the modern Germans, were the current embodiment of the Aryan race. But what this did was it allowed the Nazis to basically claim credit for anything that they wanted to claim credit for. So they believed that the classical Greeks, by which we usually mean 5th and 4th century BCE, were where the Aryans were at that time. And then, you know, later on, they move over to Italy, and that's who the Romans are. And it allows them to appropriate and claim as theirs the traditions of these two different cultures that they valued. And we should say it also allowed them, you know, to invade Greece and steal things and commit atrocities against actual Greek people themselves. So, you know, we're looking at the use of classical antiquity to justify some very serious atrocities.
Let me ask you this then, because in the Greek world, the ancient Greek world, they knew of Persia, they knew of Africa, they knew of people that looked different than they did. The Roman Empire itself, especially later on, was very much a multicultural empire. And in your deep reading and investigating into the ancient world, do you not see people from this time saying, well, we're white, they're black, or we're white and they're brown, and seeing themselves as different people?
Definitely Greeks and Romans had ideas about what we can call race. A lot of our Greek sources that, you know, really get called the classics come from Athens, and they come from the 5th and 4th century. We read, of course, a lot of other Greek texts that survive that come from other periods and other parts of the Greek world. But in the 5th century and 4th century, there's a lot of xenophobia in Athens, particularly against Persians. There had been a very serious couple of wars between Greeks and Persians, and there was a lot of, you know, frankly, racism that Greeks had against Persians. Greeks, in particular, did not necessarily peg racial differences according to skin color the way that we did, though they noticed that people came in different colors, they talked about it occasionally, and you see it depicted in Greek art as well. So it's not like they were colorblind or something like that. I mean, that's a problematic concept on its own, but they just didn't define differences quite the same way. The kind of standard dichotomy that we talk about when we talk about the Greeks and how they thought about racial or ethnic differences is they divided the world into Greeks and barbarians. And barbarians are anyone who's not a Greek. The word barbarian comes from the Greek word barbaroi, and it doesn't mean everything that we attach to that word.
It meant not speaking Greek.
Yeah, that's the kind of the base meaning. It's a little bit complicated to try to even get at whether the word barbarian is always pejorative when the Greeks use it. And I think it's not always pejorative, but it often is.
My understanding is the word came from Herodotus, who traveled all over their known world. And that he did not mean it as a pejorative.
Yeah, Herodotus is a good example to talk about the kinds of contacts that Greeks had with non-Greeks. And Herodotus, he takes essentially, I mean, we would call it a proto-scientific interest in non-Greeks. He spent a lot of time in Egypt, for instance. He seems to have traveled very widely in Egypt, and he's very interested in talking about who the Egyptians were, what their history is, what their customs are, their culture, he's very, very impressed with the monumental architecture that he saw. He's very, very interested in religious practices and the differences and also the similarities that he sees between Egyptians and Greeks. I think that for the most part, he's a very open-minded person, or he at least comes across as someone who absolutely wants to understand people from another culture and considers it intrinsically interesting to try to understand another culture. I wouldn't say that he never says problematic things about people from other cultures, but he also he takes a lot of interest in the Persians and seems interested in moving past, you know, just the sort of one-dimensional racist caricatures that you can see elsewhere in the 5th century in Athens, and to talk about the history of Persia and, again, religious practices, cultural practices that he thinks are worth knowing about.
We are in conversation with Sarah Teets. Sarah Teets is a postdoctoral fellow in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Virginia. She is a classicist, and she is the author of an article that we are in conversation about. It's called Classical Slavery and Jeffersonian Racism, Charlottesville 1 Year Later. And you can find that article along with other articles at this website, which is called Eidolon.pub. Eidolon.pub. And that's spelled Eidolon. I know I would not have known how to spell that on my own. So Eidolon.pub. We'll give that website again as we wrap up this conversation a little bit later. But it is a website that incorporates progressive politics and feminism into the classical world. Talk to me about how then Jefferson, you were starting to get into this when I kind of inserted a question about how the classical world saw race or how they mm-hmm. categorized people. But you were starting to get into how Thomas Jefferson saw slavery and how he saw American slavery as more benevolent than the ancient slavery.
Yes, this is what he says in the book he wrote and published in the 1780s called Notes on the State of Virginia.
This is the only book I think he ever wrote, isn't it?
I think that's right. Yeah. And Notes on the State of Virginia is a sort of geography and ethnography of Virginia that was composed as a series of questions to answers that were given to the Continental Congress by a French diplomat. And Jefferson was the governor of Virginia at the time that he was writing. And the portion of notes that I'm interested is known as Query 14. And it's quite infamous because Jefferson says some absolutely appalling things in Query 14. He argues very plainly for the supremacy of white people to black people, and says that, you know, essentially this justifies enslavement. It really leapt out at me when I read this about a year ago, just how reliant Jefferson is on classical sources. And it's a really key piece of his argument that he assumes that both ancient slavery in the Greek and Roman world was more cruel or inhumane than slavery in his context in Virginia. And he assumes that American slavery is essentially benevolent. And, you know, he's wrong about both of these things.
His idea, wasn't it, that in ancient Roman slavery, because there were white people who were being enslaved, that then you were enslaving people who had great talents.
Yes. So now it is, in fact, true that there were people in Greek and Roman antiquity who at some point had been manumitted and become freedmen, who who went on to become artists and intellectuals whose work survives to us. And so Jefferson says essentially that there were great geniuses among the enslaved and formerly enslaved population in Roman antiquity, and that these were all of them white people. You know, as I said earlier, that's wrong. They were not white people, but sure, you know, we can say there were some very talented people who had gained their freedom, and we know about them. You know, their work survived to us. But he also denies that there are any African Americans, not just African Americans, but any black people, anyone of African descent anywhere in the world, who are capable of the kind of talent that that he sees in the examples he gives of formerly enslaved intellectuals from antiquity. And so he really has to do a lot of mental gymnastics to deny that there's any kind of equality of intellect. But that's, you know, he kind of argues in a circle to do that. And so to him, this proves that his belief that that enslaved African Americans are inferior to their ancient Roman counterparts means that it's not the condition of slavery itself that that causes, you know, and the lack of education and all of that can cause someone to you know, not be the type of genius that Jefferson, you know, wants to see or whatever. But it's the racial difference. And I said in the article that this one of the most preposterous things about the whole thing is that Jefferson mentions Terence, the ancient Roman comic poet, as one of these white enslaved people, but we're pretty confident that that Terence actually came from Africa to Italy, that or his family did, and so it's the
and
fact
you
that
found that in his name, right? And in his entire name would tell people oftentimes where they're from.
Yes, Terence's full name was Publius Terentius Afer, and Afer is a name that is connected to a tribal group or a people group in North Africa. Afer is actually etymologically related to the word Africa itself. These people called the Afri, sometimes called the Afriki. And so the fact that that's his name suggests that he is actually from this people or descended from them. It's not like a sort of open and shut case, but that's probably that's the most likely explanation for why that's Terence's name. And so, you know, for Jefferson to make the claims that he does and include Terence in that list of white people is really just absurd.
You also write about how now Thomas Jefferson he's often, as you say, and it's instilled in everyone at the University of Virginia, is the founder of the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. You point out that, no, he's actually one of many people who are involved with the creation of this historic university. That said, though, you write about how he ensured and how there is this, I guess, initiation in order to go to the university that you had to speak Greek or Latin.
Yes. So this information I got from a document known as the Rockfish Gap Report, which was a report given to the Virginia General Assembly in about pretty much exactly 200 years ago now. It was August of 1818 that this was commissioned. And one thing that they were doing in they were working out a lot of logistics about what the University of Virginia would be at the time that they were trying to create it. And this included, sort of preliminary set of what we might call admission standards, basically. And this included that. It's never actually stated. It seems to just be a given that this is only for white men, right, to begin with. The university is only for white men. But these boys need to have been educated as boys in both Greek and Latin. They need to have gone to primary and secondary school and attained I believe what the Rockfish Gap report says is they need to have read the easier of the Greek and Latin authors. They don't specify which ones they mean by that. And part of what they're supposed to be doing when they come to UVA is finishing their knowledge of Greek and Latin by reading. I believe the phrase used in the document is the higher authors. So there's a certain sort of hierarchy that the commissioners of the University of Virginia are establishing, amongst the surviving Greek and Latin texts that are being read in Virginia schools at the time. And it sort of works, this kind of hierarchy sort of works to create and consolidate a social hierarchy among white male Virginians as well, because that's who's going to go to the university. That's who's going to, as the Rockfish Gap report makes it pretty clear, that part of the purpose of UVA is training future leaders, people who are going to occupy, offices in the state and federal government.
A number of our first few presidents were from Virginia.
Yes, that's true. That is true. A number of people involved in drafting the Constitution and all that sort of thing.
That's right. And you also see huge influences from the classical world on even in the process of adopting and also creating the Constitution. If you look at the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, they're all signed by ancient Roman names, Brutus and Publius.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's very interesting to me, the use of the sort of pseudonym, the classical pseudonyms, because I've just been thinking about how that's something that people in the alt-right are doing right now, is adopting these sort of classical pseudonyms. On the internet, of course, but also I think I read recently about somebody using the name Musonius Rufus in a white supremacist podcast or something like that. Musonius Rufus, I wrote a little bit about in my doctoral dissertation. He was a Greek-speaking Roman orator from late first century, and it just kind of shocked me. Like, why Musonius Rufus? But anyways,
have you figured it out?
Not yet. I just saw this just the other day, and I haven't looked that much closer at who this person is who's even using the name, and what seems to be the motivation, but. I think it's one of the particular ways that the alt-right is trying to appropriate Greek and Roman antiquity that I've just found again sort of baffling. But I think that looking at how the so-called founding fathers were also using these kind of I don't know if pseudonym's the right word, but it sort of elevates. It elevates what's going on, right? Because if you're calling yourself Brutus, two very very famous revolutionaries in Roman history are both named Brutus.
The king killers.
But the tyrannicide. And so if you can use Roman history to frame this revolution, then you're gonna, I suppose, make it seem all the more justified, because Brutus murdered Tarquin the Proud and the other Brutus murdered Julius Caesar. And if you accept the narratives of those histories as, good and necessary, slaughtering of the tyrants, then I suppose, it's doing some work for you.
This is non sequitur, but I just found out that John Wilkes Booth's father's middle name was also Brutus. I'm sorry. Completely non sequitur there. Not important for this conversation, but back to the word Brutus. Sarah Teets, I want to ask you this. When we are talking about the classical world and alt-right or and white supremacist groups, and I guess they're one and the same, drawing their inspiration and drawing their names and appropriating the classical world for their own means today. What about your discipline in general? And not just around race, but maybe also around issues of gender and misogyny. Are these things still a problem today in your discipline?
That's a really big question, and it's something that I spend a lot of time thinking about. And it's you're hitting on a problem that Eidolon, the Medium publication, is specifically trying to address. So it is undeniable that among classics as an academic discipline, we're quite white dominated. Historically, we're also very male dominated. We've made better progress toward gender equity in the last few decades than we have toward racial equity. And the question that a lot of us are asking or trying to grapple with right now is why have we not made better progress towards racial equity? In some ways, the article I wrote for Eidolon, I'm hoping can be a contribution to that question. And I think that, and I'm not the only one who thinks that, the ways that we have not figured out how to reckon with the past of our discipline, the way our discipline has been used in white supremacy, and here I mean it's not just the alt-right that has appropriated classics. White supremacy itself used to be much more mainstream even within the discipline a century ago, what I was hoping to accomplish with the article was essentially a call to my fellow white classicists. I'm a white person, like many of my fellow classicists, to find the courage to be honest about the past, even when it's very, very painful to know that, the department where I work was founded by Thomas Jefferson, who was using the text that I read here, where I did my PhD, to support the atrocity of slavery in this country. That's so painful to me, but I think, it's the kind of thing that we just need to, first look in the face and be honest about it. Decide what we can do to make changes. But I don't think we can make the changes we want to make if we're not willing to look in the mirror a little bit more and be honest about what we see.
We're almost out of time, but let me just get at this. This is what I think you're saying, but allow you to respond, of course. And that is that the classics, the classical world, classical studies have been used ever since we've had this notion of whiteness in order to defend that notion of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it's appropriate to do so. And that you can look at the classical world in a different way than the way they do.
Yes, I would agree with both of those. It has been the ancient Greek and Roman world has been used by white supremacists to defend white supremacy currently and in the past. I should say, in case it's not overwhelmingly clear, that this idea is absolutely appalling to the mainstream of the field, that our field could be used this way. And many of us feel like, what do we do about it? Right now, it feels like it's a sort of fringe group trying to appropriate what we're doing without really understanding. They don't have the background to even make correct claims about the Greek and Roman past. I think a lot of us feel like it's incumbent upon us to do our best to be speaking very vocally against that kind of appropriation and and looking for the best creative solutions that we can find to combat this, you know, particular use of Greek and Roman antiquity.
Sarah Teets has been our guest. Again, Sarah Teets is a postdoctoral fellow in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Virginia. In other words, she is a classicist. And she has joined us to talk about her article that could be found online at adelon.pub. Again, this is a website that's dedicated to stories and incorporates progressive politics and feminism into classical studies. And it's spelled E-I-D-O-L-O-N, adelon.pub. And our article is called Classical Slavery and Jeffersonian Racism, Charlottesville, 1 year later. Sarah Teets, I found that very interesting and very informative, and I do thank you greatly for taking time to join us today.
Well, thank you, Mitch. It's been a pleasure.
This is Letters in Politics on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I'm now joined by Alan Main. Alan Main is a visiting professor in the Center for Urban History at the University of Leicester, an adjunct professor at the University of South Australia. He has written quite a bit throughout his career about slums, and we'll even get into what the word slums means. His latest book, and we are going to be talking about this, is called Slums, The History of a Global Injustice. He joins us from Australia via Skype. Alan Main, I know it's very early for you on your side of the world, but we're quite appreciative of you for taking time to chat with us today.
Hi, Mitch. I'm happy to be talking with you.
Well, it's an interesting subject, and you make a powerful case that we really shouldn't use the word slum anymore, and we'll dive into it. But I guess the way the word is used today, what is it precisely describing anything at all?
I think even the United Nations, which persists in using the word to hang its reform programs on, has admitted that the word is desperately imprecise, so colored with pejorative meanings that it is really is entirely unhelpful. It necessarily skews any progressive reform program while facilitating private developers who are intent on bulldozing slums and replacing them with shopping malls and high-rise apartment towers.
Fair enough. But just so we get a good sense of what we're talking about when we talk about slums, is there anything we should be aware of?
Well, the word itself, and I'm drawing a distinction here between urban poverty on the one hand, which has always been a feature of cities and urbanization, and use of the word slum to describe, to explain, to rationalize, to explain away urban poverty. Now, the word slum had quite specific origins. It emerged out of popular language in London in the early 19th century. It was a Cockney term, and gradually the word's usage broadened and was used. It became used extensively by journalists, by sensationalists, by religious leaders, by reformers. Throughout the English-speaking world, in the United States and in other English-speaking British colonies like Australia, where I live, and also in English-speaking colonized territories, such as the Philippines, throughout the British Empire in Sub-Saharan Africa, in Southeast Asia, in South Asia, and so on.
Was it just a word used for poor neighborhoods?
The word originally referred to back rooms, to places where sort of illicit deviant behavior took place, and it gradually widened to backslum meanings of networks of alleys and nests of criminality, and gradually to entire districts like St. Giles and Bethnal Green and so on in London, and as it extended its usage into the New World to spots like Five Points in New York, which became notorious as one of the world's worst slums. The word, interestingly, was popularized by the novelist Charles Dickens, who wrote about Five Points, who wrote about St. Giles, Bethnal Green in London. And he recognized the power of the word to attract attention. He called it the attraction of repulsion. People increasingly, as cities became larger and larger, and those who could afford to do so lived in distant suburbs, sort of recoiled in horror from word pictures of nests of criminality and debauchery, simultaneously fascinated and repelled by those images. And it was in that context that the word slum emerged, became wide, its usage widened, and it attracted, it demanded such attention. It appealed and it repelled. It taught implicitly. It showed by highlighting the antithesis of good citizenship in the modern city. It reinforced bourgeois values.
Is there anything important to understand about the early 19th century in England and the usage of the word slum, or is this just happened to be when we get the term, but the conditions that we would associate as they would associate at that time as slums have always existed?
I guess one could explain why the word arose and attracted the power that it did at that time. We're looking at the urban revolution. We're looking at the industrial and commercial revolution. We're looking at a time when world orders, as people knew it, was collapsing and being replaced by something radically and frighteningly new. A time when old social relationships are unraveling and being replaced by new ones, which caused fear, anxiety. It's a time when people became obsessed, or some people became obsessed with the notion of the dangerous classes, the criminal classes, a worry that as the old social bonds disintegrated, working people, the poor, who were present in ever greater numbers, would become a dangerous class, would rebel, would turn against their leaders, their betters.
So this is something to understand that is, I guess, unique. And maybe unique's not the right word, but something that is always a part of a city post, or at least with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Yes, I think so. I've written about slum usage and urban inequality for many years. And in the 1990s, I wrote a book called The Imagined Slum, which looked in part at San Francisco, in part at Birmingham in England, and part at Sydney in Australia. What I didn't do then, what I failed to do, was I explained the emergence of the word slum in those contexts, but I didn't make the logical, draw the next step and say, you can see the same process at work from the middle of the 20th century into the 21st century, which is being called the urban century. You can see the same processes at work in places like India, Kenya, South Africa, with rapid urbanization, with a changing of the social and spatial landscape. You find a context in which trigger words that capture anxiety and fear and channel those responses in particular ways by marginalizing supposedly other groups and explaining and rationalizing the way things are, then you've got the same context today as you had in Britain or the United States, say, in the 1880s or the 1830s.
We're in conversation with Alan Main. Alan Main is a historian and author of the book Slums, The History of a Global Injustice. That is what we are in conversation about. So I think you're hitting on a really important point here, is once you've identified a particular neighborhood or group of people as a slum, now it kind of lays the groundwork for authorities to come in and do what they think, or at least what they say they have to do.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most fascinating examples in the contemporary world is that of Dharavi in Mumbai, which has frequently been called the world's largest slum, South Asia's largest slum, and very lurid, coloured, prejudiced descriptions of Dharavi in order to justify its demolition, its sanitization, its modernization, its replacement, its the reuse of the land for legitimate purposes like high-rise apartments and business premises, because ironically it's juxtaposed alongside Mumbai's flourishing central business district and commercial district. One of the fascinating things too about recent, I'm talking about over the last couple of decades, usage of the word slum has changed from being entirely a pejorative word to describe slum-minded people and slummy places, people and places that are characterized in entirely negative terms, to a word which is used to describe victims of urban change, victims of economic social change. And you see that being played out and explaining the continued use of the word slum by well-intentioned reformers, by officials in the United Nations who say, look at these appalling consequences of unregulated urbanization. We need to do something about this. But although the color of the word has switched, it still maintains it's still packed, it's still freighted with negative connotations, so that even in using the word sympathetically for these victims, it has a continuing sort of paternalistic, marginalizing effect, so that the reformer knows what's best for the unfortunate slum dwellers in Dharavi or wherever. The experts will step in and create solutions rather than thinking to tap into the local knowledge systems of those poor but nonetheless energetic and resilient communities.
What is a better word?
I'm not entirely sure. One of the problems about slum, I mean, it's a snappy word. It's an arresting word. It's a word that universalizes, that generalizes what are in fact a diversity of local conditions into this one abstraction. So there are multiplicity of spatial arrangements, of housing styles, of socioeconomic conditions that are packed together with this value laden word. So replacement words, you can talk about squatter communities in some instances, you can talk about tenement districts in others, and hutment settlements in others. You need to discuss that with cultural geographers, anthropologists, sociologists. But I think the key thing is to recognize the diversity of conditions, the diversity of experiences, the diversity of possibilities that are all obscured by use of this hegemonic, distorting, simplifying word.
It seems like to me what you're explaining here when we talk about, and I'll just say quote-unquote slum in all of its potential varieties and differences, one thing that, and even though it's in a city, and when, oftentimes when we think of cities and we think of buildings and we think of the permanency of them, and of course, you know, buildings are torn down all the time and rebuilt, whatever it may be, but yet it doesn't seem like it changes that dramatically. But it would seem as though what we would call quote unquote slums, those aren't permanent. Those are frequently having to change location.
There are two things I'd like to say about that. One is there is, and there have been a number of geographers, anthropologists, sociologists who've tapped into this, especially in Latin America over recent decades. Notwithstanding the perception by outsiders of chaos and chaotic movement of volatility in slum, supposedly slum districts, there nonetheless is, if one drills down with sufficient sensitivity, there nonetheless is a sense of, well, not just a sense, concrete examples of accumulation, of consolidation, of progress, of self-improvement in these slum districts, in which families, individuals, families, groups gradually build things up, gradually accumulate possessions, capital, improve their houses, replace their houses with something more solid. Fascinatingly, this has been celebrated in Daravi, for example, by neoliberal economists saying, well, perhaps we don't need so much state interference. Perhaps these slum dwellers that we've previously caricatured are in fact mini entrepreneurs, and by removing government red tape, we can encourage free enterprise to resolve the problems of the slum. That's a quirky phenomenon that's become evident in recent decades. The other point I'd like to make is that because of the perception of the volatility, the chaos of slum districts, or shanty towns, of tenement towns, this has provided an excuse, a justification for massive relocations, interventions in the poorest districts of modern cities, huge displacement of people, and always a minimum amount of attention on rehousing those thousands of people who have been evicted by slum clearance city improvement programs. You can trace this historically back into the 19th century, back into the middle of the 19th century in London, in New York, throughout the urbanized, industrialized world in the late 19th century into the 20th century. In Britain, there was a massive scheme of slum clearance through the developing 1920s into the 1930s. And you can see those same processes being played out in, I'll use the word advisedly, in the developing world today. Massive schemes of slum clearance in the name of modernity, in the name of progress, but with a minimum amount of attention to genuine efforts to rehouse those evicted by the schemes.
Alan Main has been our guest. Again, Alan Main is the author of the book. It's called Slums, The History of a Global Injustice. He joins us from Australia via Skype. Alan Main, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, found it quite interesting, and I thank you greatly for taking time to join us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Mitch. I enjoyed it.
And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
KPFA Summer Drive is over. Unfortunately, we fell well short of our goal. If you've already donated, all of us here thank you for your financial support. If you're one of our listeners that intended to pledge, please do it today. Our thank you gifts are still available. But more importantly, please do your part, and no donation is too small. Please go online at kpfa.org and support independent radio, 94.1 FM, KPFA.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.
And the time is...